your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
I'm delighted today to be able to host this live hot stock show with accomplished investor and ex-fund manager, Graham Nery of Stockopedia. So welcome, Graham.
It's a pleasure, Paul. Lovely to be speaking with you again so soon after our last little chat.
Yeah, well, that was a bit embarrassing for me just a moment ago, but I'm used to being embarrassed. But we've had quite a lot of really important macro data over the last 2 weeks, not least the sort of the big CPI prints on both sides of the Atlantic on Tuesday and Wednesday. Plus, we found out we were in the UK in a technical recession alongside on Japan yesterday. But before we sort of dig into the details of that, can you just briefly sort of talk about what type of investor sort of Graham Nery is and what type of stocks you like?
Yeah, sure. Look, I'll say very briefly, I like cheap stocks. I like high quality stocks. I study companies qualitatively, but with an eye for value. So I tend to be very selective in what I pick. And, I appreciate companies with good culture, companies with a good long history as well, often, and owner management and all that sort of good stuff. Yeah. What about yourself?
I'm fairly simple. I mean, I haven't had a sort of classic sort of, fund manager training like yourself. I was sort of like in corporate finance with GKN doing M&A and also with Unilever before that doing sort of commercial. So I'm a trained accountant by trade. And actually, it was just by coincidence, one of your colleagues, I started professionally investing at the same time as Paul Scott back in 2003. So I've been running my own money for 20 years. So it's mine is sort of like a bit of sort of trial and error and sort of experience. But I look for sort of GARP stocks typically, and my sort of like sweet spots are in software, recurring revenue streams, and healthcare. But I do like industrials as well if they've got good sort of like, you know, tailwinds behind them. So I tend to go for companies in four areas. First of all, is the company good, which is obviously all what you've talked about in terms of good management team, quality IPR. And then I look for the industry. Is there a secular tailwind involved in that? Then I see, which is always the hard bit, the place I always start is management, because I always, not always, but that's where my biggest errors have been, thinking that management are good and then it's dropped off. And then once you've done those first three key issues, what the valuation, what the price versus valuation equation is, and if it's positive, then I'll push the button and usually go in quite heavy if I can get liquidity. But before we sort of get into that macro, who is the fund manager? Which shop did you learn the sort of ropes on when you were a fund manager? Who did you work for there, Graham?
Oh, I spent about 4 or 5 years with a Canadian insurance company. It's known as it was originally the Forrester Friendly Society, and it's kind of rebranded over the years. But it's It's very big in Canada, United States, and it's decent size in the UK as well. So we had, I think it was 1.6 billion pounds under direct management at the time with the investment
Wow.
team in the UK. Now about three-fifths of that was fixed income. The rest of it was equities, and we ran it ourselves, and that was my training. I did my CFA exams at the time, and I sort of segued straight from that into being a talking head.
Well, you do that very well. There's no doubt about
yeah.
it. But I want to learn a shed load on this hot stocks, and hopefully on a few ones before. Oh, sorry, we're going after as well. So let's move on to the sort of the macro. And as I mentioned, we've got quite a few sort of we've had quite a lot of good sort of data points. Let me just go on to the relevant screen share. Where is it? Oh, crikey. So anyway, yeah, what's your sort of view? Have we sort of slain the inflation dragon, and what does that mean for sort of GDP on both sides at the Atlantic?
Yeah, I mean this technical recession thing is, I mean it's obviously a real problem. Nobody wants to see GDP falling, but it's only 0.3% or 0.1%. It's not like the COVID situation. It's not like the GFC. If GDP starts rising again, I don't think anybody will remember this as being a particularly terrible time for the economy. I mean, for me, employment is almost more interesting and more important than GDP. We've got the unemployment situation is pretty the employment situation is pretty good, I'd say. Effectively full employment, in my opinion. And
What's been quite interesting there, actually, as I noticed, is that when you if you look at the sort of the debt burden, most of the debt of the pandemic, and this is the government debt, most of the debt of from the pandemic, but also sort of investment, etc., has been borne by governments. And so, if you look at the sort of the percentage of debt to GDP, and what that means then, as you rightly say, for the consumer, is actually their balance sheets are in pretty good shape, aren't they? Even though everybody's sort of scared about sort of like losing the credit, but because even the consumer's 70% of the economy, all their debt has moved on to the government's bag.
Yeah, I mean the debt to GDP situation, I think it's about 100% in the UK roughly. So it's not ideal, but if it stayed around there, especially given that a lot of it is so long-term debt compared to America, it seems manageable. So yeah, it's For me, it's a very mixed picture economically. I do understand there is a cost of living crisis. So many companies have talked about that over the past year. It has been difficult to for households to keep pace with inflation, but at 4%, and with a lot of upward pressure on wages, maybe the situation's not that bad. I mean, if you talk to the Bank of England, they probably don't like the fact that wages seem to be rising, quickly, more fa faster than they wanted it to. But from a household point of view, it can't be such a bad thing, kind of
No,
offsetting the
I would
inflation.
agree. No, I think certainly with inflation, it may not be coming down quite as fast as people want, but if you look at the sort of the charts of the UK, the Eurozone, and the US here, they're both coming down from peaks. Inflation expectations on 5-year, 5-year are still pretty reasonable. And as you absolutely rightly point out, real positive wage growth in people's pockets. And as long as the employment situation stabilizes, or doesn't deteriorate significantly, then they should be able to fund, And I think what we're seeing, as I don't know if you'd agree with this, I think what we're seeing is a normalization of consumer spend, rather that after the surge sort of like, you know, revenge spending of everybody going abroad and the, all the goods while we were locked down. It's normalization rather than a cracking of the consumer. I mean, is, does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the main point really is that we have had an overall normalization with, you know, with interest rates going back to 5% plus from ZERP. You know, we had we had this terrible artificial situation for so long, and I'm amazed that the economy has come through rates normalizing. And yes, it is tough for a lot of people, but it, you know, it's we're sort of getting through it in a much better way than I would have expected and even hoped for. So yeah, with 5% interest rates, we're we've got a healthy situation for pension funds. Savers are a lot healthier. You know, the banks can, you know, I know bank valuations are very low, but, you know, long-term banks should be happier with a 5% base rate than zero. So for me, it's a healthy normalization of the economy that we've seen. And obviously there's hiccups along the way, but overall it seems to be going pretty well. Would you agree?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I mean, what's again surprised me, not only the interest rates have rocketed, and we haven't seen a deterioration, but likewise, we've had an inverted yield curve for almost 2 years. And that hasn't, you know, that's supposed to be sort of the number one slam dunk indicator we're heading into recession. In fact, I think it was only 12 months ago that all the sort of the experts, the capital markets experts, 100% of them were saying we're going to get a recession. And actually, what was it, last quarter, we got 5% at growth in the US, or 5% in Q3 and 3% in Q4. So that we've been so far and away, you know, sort of like, you know, wrong on that. Okay, good. In terms of sort of like central banks, I mean, the moment, obviously, at the end of last year, everybody was sort of predicting that we're going to see 6 to 7 rate cuts in the US and similar in the UK. And now, as just from this one, we've had the bond yield curve picking up over the last month, which has obviously been a bit of a lead weight on equities, particularly UK ones, small caps. What's your sort of like view on central banks going forward? Because we do seem to be getting a bit of a divergence with GDP. We've got the UK and Europe in a sort of technical recession, but normalization. But we've still got the US going gangbuster on the back of all of that fiscal spend. Which so we may get different timings for different rate cuts. What's your sort of view on that with central banks? Because that's a key driver of equity returns.
Yeah, I mean, I don't claim to be an expert on central banks, but I do think America, the United States, is incredible that they show such discipline. You know, a lot of people sort of criticized the United States for its you know, for its wasteful spending over the years, and its, you know, its debt burden and so on. But then when push came to shove, they raised interest rates more aggressively than pretty much everyone else. They've still got a higher interest rate than the Bank of England, higher than the ECB, and they've got faster GDP growth. So it sort of seems like they're winning from every perspective, no matter which way you look at it. Pensioners and savers have done well. The stock market's boomed. The unemployment rate is even lower than the UK, not by much, but just the point is that on every metric, they've just done incredibly well. So I don't know what you can do except tip your hat to them.
Yeah. I mean, I think in terms of timings for central bank, you know, interest rate reductions, it looks though, and I agree with you, you've got to tip your hat to the US, and they probably don't need to reduce interest rates as fast as maybe the Bank of England. So if it comes as a stock picking, if you're looking at interest rate sensitive areas, your house builders, your building stocks, autos and all this sort of stuff, then they're probably looking at, you know, a nearer term turnaround and recovery in the UK and Europe than the US, I'm guessing. And that's not yet been priced into the market, because as you can see here, we've got expectations of central bank cuts, and basically it's almost like in unison even after the latest moves for the UK and the US, and the Eurozone is going down by a similar amount. So okay, good.
Yeah, well, interesting.
Yeah. So in terms of sort of, we've just come through the US corporate season, you know, reporting season. Is there any sort of key takeaways that you've seen in terms of, because we've had Meta blowing the socks off earnings, and that was up 20% on the day. We've got Nvidia next week, and we've had every single tech stock has been shedding headcount.
Yeah, I mean, I don't spend a huge amount of time studying them, but I do own. I do own Berkshire Hathaway. I know I own Alphabet as well in my personal portfolio. I've also been a long-term skeptic of Tesla, which people will know from my Twitter account, etc.
You were short it at one stage, weren't you?
Yeah.
That was potentially a dangerous move.
Well, I got out of there. You know, that's the thing when you're shorting, you've got to get out of it in time.
Yeah.
And so through Berkshire Hathaway, I do own Apple. And then I suppose what does concern me is when I look at the rise of the passive market, the passive investors, and then you see that people are piling into Nvidia at these valuations. It's kind of a little bit scary when you see how much passive money is going into Nvidia and even Tesla at this level. The Magnificent Seven, as they're called, but I think obviously the Magnificent Seven includes some magnificent companies, but it wouldn't take much to sort of knock them over and really deal a huge blow to passive investors. So I do worry about that, the vulnerability of the US market from that point of view.
Yeah, you raised two really good points. First, on valuation of the sort of the Mag 7. I mean, I saw Nvidia, I think, trades over 20 times sales at the moment. And I know the earnings is about 40, 45 times, but it's just ridiculous margins. It's sort of like unsustainable margins and probably unsustainable price to sales. But actually, after the recent surge in ARM, the UK technology company, which listed NASDAQ, after that recent surge in results, it's on 35 times sales, which just seems, I mean, that's straight out of the dot-com boom, isn't it? You know, I mean, it's crazy valuation. All you know is that it's a great company with great technology, but it's probably in the price when it gets to that level.
Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't understand it. I don't claim to understand it. Yeah. People talk about our artificial intelligence and so on, but I don't get it.
Yeah. And then just on that other point you raised with regards to passive investing, I mean, you've got more than 50% of the US market now, but the money is run through passives, which is basically follow somebody else buying, buy more of it if it goes up and sell more if it goes down. It just seems totally lopsided, certainly when it comes to price discovery. I mean, obviously, there's a place in the market for people who just want to sleep at soundly at night and just want to track the market. But it does get to a stage whereby if there's actually presumably puts a sort of like a risk underneath the market, because things can unwind very quickly.
I don't know if you're familiar with David Einhorn of Greenlight Capital. He's one of my investing heroes because he has some brilliant short theses over the years, and he's a value investor. But he's recently been quoted, and it's kind of hilariously sad in a way, because he's saying that he can't invest the way he used to, because it used to be the case that you'd make an earnings forecast for a small company and then it would beat forecasts and then the price would go up and you'd make a return. But he's saying that actually there's nobody watching these companies anymore. He's saying there's the active investors have left. And so now he makes these forecasts and he might be right, but it actually won't make a difference to the share prices anymore, because there's nobody correcting the prices of these companies anymore. So, I mean, it speaks to an opportunity for long-term investors. But I thought it was interesting because you asked me that question the other day about, the small companies not really moving much when you think they should be moving. And that's an example of a very experienced, a brilliant investor in America who's basically saying the same thing. I've given up, expecting a return over a 2-year time period if I get my estimates right, because everybody's passive now. Nobody's going to correct pricing anomalies for me anymore.
Yeah, you've raised an absolutely fabulous point there, because once you lose price discovery, i.e., what the correct price is, and price and value become effectively you end up getting an inefficient market. That's what we're effectively saying, but not only in the small caps, but also in the large caps as well. And just, you're right, if you're a very good stock picker, then there's opportunity. And here's on the valuation metrics. I mean, you can see NASDAQ 100 on about 27 times. You've got the S&P on about 21 times, and the UK small cap on 12. Now, what that doesn't do is actually overlay the growth profile of the earnings. But when you do that, you then get the PEG ratios, and it's even more extreme. And I think, we certainly where your sort of sweet spot is with Stockopedia, it's down here. And if you've got a PEG ratio of less than one, it's usually good value. But at 0.7, I mean, I don't know if you want to talk on that one at all. We're going to go through some opportunities at the moment, but presumably you're seeing some quite good opportunities.
I suppose the risk there, as you know yourself, Paul, is that if you're fishing in AIM, you're going to get some boot, some old boots, and you're going to get some tin cans, and you're going to get things you don't want there when you're fishing in that market. So, you
Just
can,
got to be careful. Yeah, well, that's why we subscribe to you and Paul, you see, so you can hold our hands through all this. Okay, good. Well, let's move to some stocks of the last 2 weeks. We've got one of you talked about was Water Intelligence yesterday, which came out with a trading update, and this one does sort of leak detection. A bit of a mixed model. It's sort of franchised largely out in the States, but also owns some of the franchisees, and also has a water sort of prevention stroke, leak detection, but also it helps utilities do sewage management in the UK. Came out with an inline trading update. Do you want to take us through your view on this one? Because I just know a bit about it because I own it.
Yeah, well, I imagine you probably know more about it than I do, Paul. But from what attracted me to it was the franchise model. Again, we spoke about that the other day. A little bit complicated, the fact that they're buying back franchises kind of does raise a question mark about, how well is the franchise model working if they're having to buy them back. But you could argue that it is a cost of running the model, that occasionally franchisees won't be successful and you'll have to come in and fix the situation for them. So they've been buying back a few franchises across the United States. Overall, I've gone positive on this one. Bit of a close call for me, but valuation has come off quite a lot. If you zoom out to like a multi-year chart, I suppose you've got the multi-year chart there. So valuations come off a fair bit there, and I think the track record's pretty decent. Growth is a little bit low right now in terms of network sales, which is what I look at more than revenue. So network sales being sales to customers, not revenue to the company, which is a
Yeah,
different
which
thing.
went up, it was less, didn't go up as much, did it? It was about, was it 3% or something, the network sales?
Network sales was 3%. So that's below US inflation. Well, it's below inflation generally. So that's a little bit disappointing, but at the same time, pre-tax profit was up 13%, which was very good. So overall, I generally like what I see there, but what's your view on it?
Yeah, I mean, I this the reason why I've invested my investment thesis is it's never going to shoot the lights out. But you can tell from the chart and from what it's done in history, it's a serial compounder. So I'd like to hold this for 5 to 10 years. And if I do sort of 10, 15% per annum gross return, that's absolutely fine to me. And it trades on about 13 times PE for really quite a unique asset. And you've got experienced management team who has got a big skin in the game and are buying shares effectively through their incentive schemes, which is what they do for their bonuses. They take shares instead. Then they obviously believe in it, and they've got a lot of sort of personal skin in the game. But they'll want to retire at some point in time. And I could see somebody, private equity, taking these out at some point. At what price is another question. I mean, you've got Shore Capital on about, I think it's 800p per share. That looks a bit toppy to me. When I do a sort of 15 to 20 times multiple, I'm getting about £5, and that's where I would see it. But no, it's very much a sort of like, hey, just leave this one. And at some point in time, you're going to get some good news. It'll either, don't expect it to knock the ball out of the park. It's not going to be a sort of like a Plexus or, you know, one of these high risk. It's got a solid balance sheet. It's got good customers who like it. And it's in a nice, it's in a very good secular trend industry of water prevention, I think.
It's probably got a lot in common with franchise brands, would you say?
Yeah, you're probably right. It hasn't got as much debt as franchise brands. But it's franchise brands is that B2B, isn't it? That's a nice business and it's good. It's a sort of that's more of a sort of like a buy and build. Whereas this one, I think that Water Intelligence really tends to buy sort of its own franchisees or bring or buy in specific technology that it can then leverage over its base. So good.
Yeah, okay. I do agree with you. It was over. I do think it was overpriced before, but it's probably come back to a decent yeah. level here.
Yeah. One other thing I just would be, you know, like just to mention here is that I have actually just bought, topped up my position. I've been talking about it for quite some time in another controversial sort of like company called Argentex.
Oh, yeah.
And it basically is a international Forex payments company. And it's been through the mill, as you can see on its share price. Okay. So I think it listed at about £1 or something, took that 3 or 4 years ago, and it's come down now to below 60p. And I know a lot about this particular area. It's trades at about sort of 6 to 7 times P, masses of cash, et cetera. And its USP is that it does a sort of like white glove type of service for high net worth investors and B2B businesses, and also for funds, etc. And it's had a management bust up essentially. New interim has gone in there, plus they've had a new chairman, and they're sort of like doing a strategic review to turn the business round. What sort of piqued my interest, particularly last week, is that the old CEO, and I don't know, this is my speculation because it hasn't been a TR on where doing it a funding. The old CRO, Harry Adams, has actually offloaded a big chunk of shares, who has then fallen into the kind lap of Richard Staveley, who's a bit of a rock star, sort of like, you know, fund manager with Rockwood Strategic. And he's bought about 4-5% of the company. Anyway, so I followed in him last week, which meant I had to sell a couple of things. But I thought I'd just let people know, because I know you've also in the past done an analysis of that. And the thing is, you've got to get your head around, is it cheap for a reason, or is it cheap and there's a turnaround? I don't know if you're familiar with this or whether you've had a look at it, but it's certainly pretty cheap.
I have had a little look at this one. There probably must, I presume there's still an overhang if Harry Adams sold 4%.
Yes, yes.
There's still going to be that overhang left.
That is an excellent question, because he hasn't disclosed his TR1, so he's probably working the order. And if there is an overhang, then I think more people will start getting on board. And once he's out, and it might be painful in the short term, once he's out, then you'll see a significant re-rating. But yeah, you do raise a good point there. He did have about 15 million shares. I think he's probably sold about 4 or 5.
I mean, I would worry about a sort of loss of direction, possibly. With all the founders, I think all the founders are gone now, possibly.
Yes, they are. Yeah, both founders are out of the business. Yeah.
Yes, I just wonder, would it? You know, I would see them as being very essential to sort of strategy and vision. And I'd like to know if the new, they have an interim CEO, I believe.
Yeah.
So Jim Ormond. They're going to need a permanent CEO, and then you'd want to hear something about what the vision is long term.
Yeah, no, I think you make me more excited, to be honest, actually, because when somebody puts a strategic review and your sort of questions, I'd like to know more and a bit strategic direction, what does that say to me? That says to me, if anybody's interested in buying this business from an external, you might well see the strategic view isn't redo all the strategy. It's actually what we've done is put a for sale sign over the top of the castle. And if somebody wants to have a good look at us, then we are available for a chat. But we're not actively soliciting the business. But if people want to go and go and kick the tires on it on a very cheap valuation with synergistics, then and in a consolidating industry, I don't know. I'm probably reading between the lines, but we'll wait and see. Okay, well, let's move on to even more cheaper stock, which I'm surprised you haven't actually bought, is one you covered yesterday, which is Jarvis, not sorry, Jarvis, it's new Close Brothers, because it had a bit of a shocker. It came down like 30% yesterday on the back of some FCA commissions, but I think it's super cheap now, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I always thought that Close Brothers was a very respectable, you know, long-standing financial institution, you know, worthy of respect. But the market is giving it no respect now, none whatsoever. And I'm astonished. You know, I looked at this company a couple of years ago when it was probably trading over £10 a share. And I thought, yeah, it looks okay here. It looks nice. Looks like a nice business. And that now we're below £3. So I think probably... now this might be a little bit optimistic, but I'm imagining that a lot of the sellers are just people who want dividends and who are upset that the dividend has been suspended. Personally, I don't have a problem with Close Brothers suspending its dividend in the circumstances. I'm not really a dividend investor anyway, so it wouldn't really bother me, but They were trading on a yield that looked unsustainable, and it's turned out that in fact it was unsustainable from the point of view of the company. I suppose the yield was 15% or 17% or something, and now it's gone straight to zero.
Zero, yeah.
Because they're saying that there's an unquantifiable loss or penalty that they could be facing. Who knows what it could be? It could be zero, but they are facing some kind of impact from the motor finance review.
Quantification, I mean, I'm just looking here, just doing the maths, okay? From £8 down to £3, and then you look at the number of shares, it's 150 million shares. So that's five times 150 million, which is 750 million of market cap destroyed. What type of litigation? I mean, it just seems that so extreme, because I've seen estimates of this whole, you know, motor finance problem in the press. And yes, it could be potentially put out as the PPI. But the worst case, apparently, is Lloyd's, which has got about 1.3. But are we really saying that Close Brothers has got an exposure of about 700 million market cap, which would warrant that fall? I mean, it just seems... I don't know. How many fleets of cars have they got out there? I don't know.
And I mean, it was another £150 million of market cap lost yesterday.
Yeah.
Just from saying that they were going to keep money in the business instead of paying it to shareholders.
Yeah.
I mean, there wasn't really anything else in the update. I mean, they acknowledged that they could face a loss, but I thought everybody would have assumed that. Everybody knew that already. So,
yeah.
You know, price to book here is obviously, you know, very low. I think their tangible book value was 1.3 billion roughly.
Yeah.
So market cap now less than half a billion. They are more leveraged than other financial stocks that I take an interest in, but if you look at their capital ratios, like, you know, which they publish like any other bank, All those ratios are at, you know, levels which look healthy. So, I mean, famous last words here about when you think a bank is safe or a bank is a good investment. I wouldn't be betting the house on this one by any means, but on a risk to reward basis for a small bet, has to be worth a look.
Yeah, I would. I mean, I think the net tangible assets is around about 650p. So it's, you know, it's less than half of that. And also, there's a good saying in the city, which you probably know better than I. You know, buy on the sound of cannons, isn't it? And this is the biggest cannon that's been blown out there. It just seems. I mean, hey, you know, you and I, when you do a desktop review, you just scratch the head and say this must be value here. But we've both lived through the great financial crisis, didn't we? So when we had RBS going to almost zero and lots of other businesses, you've got to, you know, banks can always go lower, can't they?
I mean, here's another way to look at it, Paul. They've just in their update yesterday, they said that in H1, the period which has just ended in January, they expect to report adjusted operating profits of £94 million. So even if they were fined £100 million by the FCA. If they can convert their adjusted operating profit into cash, okay, they'll have to pay tax on that. But you can see that they can sort of potentially pay fines out of their profits as well in a worst case scenario. Maybe this is too optimistic, but I find it does seem to be priced for Armageddon.
Yeah, I would agree. Okay, good. Well, let's move on to another one, which is a bit more sort of higher risk, smaller company, which came out with news, which is Cornerstone FX. And this is again an international payments firm. And they came out with news this last week, which was basically saying that it got approval to expand out into to Canada. It got a regulatory license. It's got a sort of, it does it again, it does sort of like white glove Forex payments services to businesses and to high net worth individuals. What's really interesting here to me is, you know, it's still, it's the shares have gone up, you know, quite a lot over the last year or so, as you can see, from roughly around about 10, 11p to, well, tripled, yeah. But actually, it's still, they only trade on, and this is very conservative estimates, they only trade on, what is it, roughly around about 1.6 times sales now. And that sales is based on 11 and just over 11 million from Shore Capital. And I just think they're going to blow. I mean, if you're looking for a stock that is actually going to blow through estimates, then this is the one, because it did 6 million of turnover in the second half of 2023. It's currently forecast by its broker, its estimates, to do 11.3 million of turnover in the whole of this year. So that's assuming sales contract, which I just don't believe. when it doubled its sales last year, it more, you know, we went from sort of like, you know, it was about 4 or 5 million to 11 to 9.6 million last year. So it's on real momentum, and it's got these regulatory. So it's a higher, clearly it's there's a lot of, you know, it's re-rated, but I think there's still a long way to go. And again, it's something to stick on the stock watch list, because, you know, you look at it over a 5-year view, and it's still, you know, when it started at about 50p, so there's still quite a long way to go. But I don't know if I know Paul had bought this one, didn't he, at one stage, and then wanted to put it into Plexus, I think.
Yeah, I suppose the difficulty I have, Paul, is that there's, as you know, we were just talking about our Gentex. I do find it difficult to understand what differentiates these companies. Like Cornerstone say they have a proprietary technology, but I mean, what does this really mean? I mean, they say they have multi-currency accounts, but a lot of people have a lot of companies provide multi-currency accounts. So I'm not sure what is the USP there. Like if I could buy into a fintech, I'd buy into Revolut probably. These Cornerstone, I just don't know I don't know what sets them apart from the
Great,
competition.
great question. I mean, Cornerstone and Argentex, and also Equals, service the B2B side. So what they have is basically a treasury management. It's like an ounce. So let's just put yourself into the boots of a treasurer for, let's just say, I don't know, you know, GKN or Unilever or somebody like that. Now, you didn't want to employ some really expensive head office guys to be able to do all your Forex buying and all your Forex selling. You just wanted somebody to be able to, you know, say, right, okay, we would need this amount of currency at this time to pay our suppliers or to pay our employees around the world. We'll get somebody else to do the forward deals and obviously to buy out, you know, on the futures contracts for us. It's effectively, it's an outsourcing business, because they do all the heavy lifting for corporates to save them costs. Not only do they don't have to have the expertise, which then builds in that moat into the business, because they become dependent on you because you have that relationship with the person, but also they're cheap, much cheaper than their existing bank. So when they're using, like, you know, a Barclays or an HSBC, the price is a lot is clearly, you know, better, and they have that locked in relationship with the corporate or with a high net worth individual. So when it comes down to what's the differentiation, that is essentially it. It's B2B, it's building in the customer relationship and then bolting on the software and the expertise to be able to not only give them a better transaction rate, but more importantly, to get them the good rate and to be able to do, you know, large. They might do, let's just say, for instance, a Unilever wants to do an acquisition of somebody. Unilever is probably too big a business, but, you know, they wanted to buy, I'm just guessing here, 100 million of euros, you know, to be able to pay for an acquisition 6 months' time. These guys would do it for them.
Right. Well, yeah, thanks for the explanation. Yeah, it does astonish me that the big, you know, the high street banks seem to be asleep at the wheel, or, you know, they're making so much money from the people who don't switch and don't look for alternatives that they don't care, you know, about the few people who do leave them and go and find the alternative solution. So, yeah, that is interesting. Thank you.
Well, I've been using, I was a customer, I'm in, you know, of HSBC, and I am shocked how poor their customer service is on the wealth management, but their technical systems are atrocious. And it's just, is sort of like, I don't know what's happening. I actually think across the whole banking landscape, the morale is awful, because they've just got rid of so many people, and they've got so many silos of historical legacy systems they haven't been able to bring together. It just made it so difficult. I don't know. The culture just doesn't seem right to me in terms of bringing competing. But anyway, such is life. But I think you've just got to look at what the numbers are. And when you get a company growing by 100% turnover, is it really going to contract the following year?
Oh no, it sounds like brokers need to maybe update their forecasts there on that one.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Well, let's move to another one in the sort of the broker area, which is one you covered, I think, yesterday, Jarvis Securities, which is sort of like a boutique-y bank that came out with, I think it was a dividend or something, and the shares shot up. So, but it looks cheap anyway. So, what's your latest on this one?
Yeah, I see it's up again today. In fact,
but is it? You've been buying, haven't you? That's what it is.
No. I'm a former shareholder here. I understand this company reasonably well, I'd say. It's kind of like the Ryanair of your stockbrokers.
That's gone just vertical, hasn't it?
Yeah. So the problem is they've had some regulatory issues, and you know, the FCA has taken an interest, and there's going to be a review or a report from one of these so-called skilled person reviews will be going to the FCA by the end of the month.
Do they employ skilled people at the FCA?
I think the skilled person is a consultant, I believe.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah. So now they cancelled their Q4 dividend last year at the end of 2023. And it was all very odd, because they... At the time they cancelled their dividend, they said, well, our full year dividend is still as expected, because the brokers had penciled in a full year dividend of, you know, a certain amount, which, you know, assumed that the Q4 dividend would be cancelled. Anyway, it's very strange. But a lot of shareholders then were worried about the Q1 dividend, and they thought, this is it now. They're going to tell us that there's no Q1 dividend, and then there's going to be bad news from the skilled person review, and the whole thing is going to go to pot. But they are paying a Q1 dividend, 1.75p. That was announced yesterday, and brokers actually had a 9p full year dividend for 2024 forecast.
Wow,
they've shaded that down slightly to 8p. But I think,
so it's still on a monster yield.
Well, look, shareholders, I think, should be delighted with anything non-zero. And probably what I said yesterday was, you know, they should be targeting at least 7p and up to 9p, you know, which was the original broker forecast, could still be possible. And if they're paying that dividend, I suppose the reason everybody's been piling into the shares over the last 48 hours is you would kind of hope that the situation with the FCA is sort of not as damning or horrific as it might have been, and that they'll pull through. So
do you know what this is about? I mean, it's just trying to actually quantify this, give the magnitude of it. I mean, do we know, have we got any suspicion of what this review is or investigation? I mean, is it how big is it and how long is it? I mean, what are we talking about?
Yeah, so it's basically they've got a B2C section, and then they've got this other section where they provide kind of white label services to brokers. And the problem is they've not been doing they may not have been following all the rules associated with that.
Like alleged money
Possibly.
laundering by people, that sort of stuff. They may not have been doing the know your customer checks, something like that, or.
I feel like I need to be careful what I
Yeah,
say, but
no. It's all speculation. Nobody knows.
nobody knows, you know, but there may be an issue where they didn't, you know, do all the checks that they
Okay.
should have done
Yeah,
on
okay.
the B2B side. So
Okay.
that's what it's about.
Yeah, okay. All right, good. Okay, well, let's move on to another one, which it's got a bit of a debt burden. It's one I'm going to put onto the stock watch list for future. It's called Maintel Holdings. Again, it's trading at ridiculously cheap valuation. I think it's on about 7 times PE. What is it? 7.1 times PE. It's not yet paying a dividend, but hopefully will sort of like, you know, return to the dividend level. Let me just get the chart. What it basically does is an outsourced does buy, build, and design of, sorry, d d design, build, and operate of sort of communication services. So your web, your broadband for businesses around the UK and also for the sort of public sector. And it acts as the first line sort of support. So the network operating center. So let's just take an example. If they've got a sort of hospital that has an employee's staff count of, say, 500 people, then they will outsource the running of their broadband and internet communications to these guys who will act as the help desk, as the first line support, and will actually manage all those seats. So they the benefit to the customer is that they then pass the costs all obviously over to, you know, they have a lower level of cost. They have them got to manage it, etc. And that's what main, you know, Maintel do. And they've been growing that. They've slipped up a few, you know, of recent term. They've got a new management team, a new chairman on board. And it's been sort of like pretty much discarded as a share for the last 2 or 3 years. The reason why it sort of piqued my interest was that Christopher Mills owns quite a few shares, and he's been sort of talking about it. And as you can see, they've bottomed and they've started to improve, but there's still a long way to go. 75% of the turnover is recurring revenues, and you know, once you get the economies of scale, once you get sort of like locked into a customer, it's like anything, isn't it? You know, not your software system. You just don't want to sort of like lift and shift somebody else in because the amount of disruption. So the switching costs are really, you know, sort of like, you know, big. And therefore, you've got just adding extra turnover each year to a recurring revenue base. Now, the only sort of like thing they've been doing over the last 2 years about to do, because they bought an acquisition. And they probably didn't integrate it as well 2 or 3 years ago. Then they've got a bit of debt. It's about 18 million, which is about, I think it's less than 2 times EBITDA. But it's again, it's not a one, it isn't a stock that's going to shoot the lights out, but actually there's still quite a lot of recovery. And I'll just give you my sort of valuation of it. I think if you did it on a sort of 10 times PE, which isn't exactly very expensive, I think you get to about 330. And I think the broker's on about 4 quid. But it's again, it's a sort of like a bit like a water intelligence kind of business. You just keep adding on new customers, but it's a competitive industry, clearly.
And so they've been loss making, and that's led to management leaving, I presume, and a change of a strategy they seem to be talking about.
It's been a turnaround strategy. What they've been doing is rather than actually just doing generic communications. They've been putting in more sort of like, you know, tailored and niche things. So special things like, you know, they'll put cybersecurity on board. They'll do, you know, any specific design and tailorization to the customer. So let's just say, for instance, a hospital is going to be absolutely red hot on data security, patient data security, or employee data security, or even because the NHS was attacked, wasn't it, by a virus, you know, sort of 2 years ago. There'll be a few things. So they tailor it to the actual customer and bring that in. And then they run off the rails of a lot of the sort of major sort of like, you know, IT equipment and software suppliers. So people like Cisco and Avaya and people like that. So they act as essentially the main tail actor is the first line support, but if there's a real technical issue, there's sort of bug fix, etc., second line and third line, then they go, then their help desk will manage and their tech line will manage that bug fix through the technology guys, you know, to fix it off for their particular customer. So it's the reason why I raise it. It's come off a lot. There's a long way to go. It's still only 34 million market cap, and I think the new exec chairman, a lady called Carol Thompson, seems to be doing a good job to get this business up and rolling, because they had a positive trading update, which was, you know, just before Christmas, and you can see the shares, you can see them just ticking up. And I mean, they've, you know, from their lows, they've more than doubled. And I think that strategy is now working through. It was sort of like profit warning, you know, what's this business doing sort of stuff. And then, you know, Christopher starts picking up shares. Other people start realizing this is still too cheap, and it's on about a 7x multiple. But with the point is, it can actually pay down that debt because it's cash generative and has got, such high recurring revenues.
I suppose the debt is about half the market cap still. So that's...
Yeah.
I suppose you do need to take that into account.
Into the valuation. If you do it
get an EV, it's probably 10 times EV already, is it?
Do it on an EBIT margin, so not an EBITDA margin, but you do it on an EBIT margin, you still only get 8.3 times. And these things, you know, the things like a lot of these companies get taken out on sort of 14, 15 times, you know, multiple. So you can see how for a private, you know, if you had a roll-up, private equity roll-up, they would, in the private markets, they would strip out everything below gross margin because they would just push it into another business.
Sure. Yeah. No, certainly it looks as if they got a solid year or two under their belt, there'd be a good scope for re-rating there.
Well, the problem is that when they have 2 years underneath their belt, that the shares will have already gone. That's the problem with the markets. They beat you to it, don't they? They sort of run ahead of things. Okay, the last one, it was again a bit of a turnaround. Gone through is Watches of Switzerland that I know you had a look at, and they had a bit of a bloodbath. It was it's a favourite of Cockney Rebel Richard Crowe, isn't it? On who used to love it, but don't want a few words on that. Is there a buying opportunity here, or is it still sort of like keep well away from expensive watches?
Yeah, I'm sort of in dangerous territory here because. You know, when you start to think that something looks cheap, but then you also know that there's few issues with it. There's some potentially serious issues. You know, when I was reading about this one, I started to think, I thought to myself, wouldn't it be great if we could buy shares in Rolex? And it took me about 30 seconds to realize that's owned by a private foundation. So not possible. So we're left with Watches of Switzerland, which is kind of the poor man's Rolex. So they've got a couple of issues. The watch market has been of interest to me as well because I follow the pawnbrokers very closely.
Yeah.
And, you know, they've been reporting issues with watches. So, I mean, our mutual friend, Paul Scott, he sort of thinks that watches are... are in some kind of a fad. I'm not sure I agree. But
what do you wear? What watch do you wear?
Believe it or not, I don't wear a watch.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, I've been wearing a watch for some time, but if I did, it'd be a Casio job.
Casio.
but no, what you raise is a really good point. And first of all, in terms of read across from other areas, because you track the Ramsdens and the H&Ts, and when you see them talking about watch sales, then you're right. Then you can really get a lens into these kind of guys as well, can't you? So what if you've seen, did you see softness in Ramsdens, and therefore you saw, or was it in, and then you sort of like went into, you know, you had to put the read across into Watches of Switzerland?
You know, it was actually H&T. They're very good in watches because they actually bought a company that services watches to bring that in house, and so they've got all the expertise. They've got incredible technology for studying watches and figuring out what's wrong with them and so on. But in terms of the retailing trends, they've actually reduced their exposure to watches.
Yeah,
they found that in terms of lending on watches became less attractive, and retailing watches, I think, also became more difficult. So obviously, when this a perfect read across to Watches of Switzerland, where they're actually seeing revenue down, falling. So their Q3 update saw revenue falling. Strangely, though, watches didn't seem to be the worst part of it. They were talking about other jewelry as well being really weak. So I'm not sure, how to make of that exactly. But basically, they're struggling, especially in the UK. Again, we were talking earlier about the US versus UK. US revenue is actually up, and they're growing market share over there. In the UK and in Europe, revenues were down 5%. I mean, there's a couple of issues there. The VAT-free shopping has been an issue for them. That's something I study the casinos as well. Rank Group, who own Grosvenor Casinos, they were saying that there's an issue in terms of high net worth visitors to the UK. Same thing here with Watches of Switzerland, saying that VAT-free shopping, the lack of it, is a problem. So now I am kind of optimistic that that could come back. There's been a few rumors and reports that VAT-free shopping could come back, and that would be a huge boost. So that could help to improve things. But overall, I'm tempted by Watches of Switzerland on a, in terms of valuation, it is, it's
It's
trading at
cheap,
about
isn't it? It's on a
eight.
9x PE with cash on the balance sheet. It looks like, to me, it looks like a bit of a value trap, actually, because what you've just said to me is they're expecting sales to soften. We've seen that through the others. And actually, their April 25 numbers are for an increase in sales with a rising operating margin, which looks, it's plausible, but it looks in this circumstances, you've got to put a question mark whether they're going to have another profit warning here.
Yeah, I'm not mentioning this as a share that I'm like particularly positive on at all. I agree with you entirely. It's looking quite risky, but it's kind of that annoying point where you look at the PE multiple and you think, it's starting to look cheap, and that's so dangerous. In terms of the debt, you're right that they've got a decent balance sheet, but a classic retailer value trap is the leases. Leases used to be off balance sheet. These have the best part of £500 million of lease liabilities on their balance sheet under the current accounting rules. And so these are very expensive properties in prime locations. So I'm not particularly positive on this one, but I do think it's an interesting one to keep an eye on, and there's read across to other companies from it as well.
Okay, we've got a few questions coming in, so I know we've talked about that. We've got Matthew Roberts saying thoughts on Card Factory selling of Telos holding this down and seems very good value. He asks, I don't know if you're familiar. I think this is a Paul Scott type stock, but any views on Card Factory?
Again, I sort of put it in that retail value trap category, highly commoditized, but probably cheap, probably value. It's not something that I'd be buying myself. I'm not sure if you've got a view.
It isn't Card Factory to me. The business model, to be brutal, is doesn't fit the sort of like the high IPR type stuff, recurring revenue streams, secular growth. It just didn't. I know it's cheap, but I try and avoid those type of stocks because I do find I scratch my head in terms of really looking at their barriers to entry. I would look. Who would want to buy it, and if there's an optionality when it comes to a share that a private equity guy or another trade buyer would pick it up, then I would do. It's not mine. Another one from Lemon Physical says, "Welcome on board, Graham. It is great to have you on the show." So you've got a few fans there already.
Well, thank you, Lemon Physical.
If anybody wants to ask any more questions, sorry about that. I was a bit late on asking them, but just please put your questions on the in the board, and then I will ask Graham about those. It just turning now to sort of, have you been selling anything in your portfolio? Have you, over the last few weeks, have you been sort of trimming or anything you've been lightening up? And also, what's your sort of your sort of, you know, holding period, you know, length of time typically, and also your number, your cash holding level.
Yeah, so I'm just fully invested, and I don't talk about my personal portfolio all that much because I would never sort of recommend anybody to do it. I have 50% in my top two holdings. I have 90% in my top six holdings, and I just hold these things until there's some kind of event where I take over.
Okay. Well, what do you just give? What are your two biggest holdings anyway?
Yeah, so I'm kind of locked into Valvery. This is a bit of a sensitive one because the founder and the chief executive very tragically died last year. He's a young man, and so his brother is now running the company, and it's I'm just sort of waiting to get some kind of an update there in terms of future plans.
What's the ticker on? What's the ticker on Valvery?
VLE.
VLE.
Yeah, so I it's very illiquid.
Yeah. Oh, okay, yeah, got you.
And I don't talk about it very much. I'm just waiting for them to decide what they're going to do next. Now that they lost the founder.
And what's the other one?
Berkshire Hathaway.
Oh, okay, yeah. So you've got one higher risk and one sort of like rock solid.
And then my other stuff. You know, I've had a really tough year with Burberry. Burberry's down a lot. But on the other hand, I've had a great year with Alphabet. Alphabet's up 50%. I hold IG Group. That's been a long-term holding for me. And that's why I like talking about CMC as well. As we discussed before, probably wish I owned CMC as well.
You can't own everything. That's the thing about being a stock picker. Problem.
And then I do own Next as well. And I've been a long-term holder of Next. So I would like to recycle and, you know, move into a few other stuff. But those are my top six holdings. If there's some kind of movement in Valvery, then I'll probably recycle that into some more stuff. But I kind of hold this stuff for years and years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I was fully loaded into the stock market about 2 weeks ago, but I wanted to buy Argentex, so I've sort of like sold a couple, and also just had to pay for a new kitchen and some landscaping and tax bills and all this sort of stuff. So I've come out of RWS, which is a language translation business, and also TPI Cap I sold, which is a bit like your IG index, but at a over OTC securities it does. And GB Group as well, but GB Group it keeps going up, and so people think momentum, which is fine. I just don't understand momentum, and I just took a profit. It was on 22 times PE, and I thought, okay, well, I'll recycle it into something like six or seven times. So I thought I'd let people know. But my I think I've got about 15% cash now. Now, you've got another question here, Graham. No, it's from Lemon Physical again. He's the guy who said, welcome on board. He says, any thoughts on gaming realms? Which I think is something that Paul has talked about, which does software. Slingo Bingo, is it? Is the thing that they do? I don't know what the valuation is, but I think they supply it as a mobile game and as an online game into other online casinos and get a royalty off the back of it.
Gaming realms, yeah, I've not covered this one. I'm very sorry to say. Have you got a view on it, Paul?
I don't know. I'm just going to sort of get it up.
I've not covered. I'll be curious. I'm familiar with the ticker, but I don't believe that I've studied it.
Let me just. There it is. Gaming realms.
That 15 times PE. It has been profitable for the last couple of years.
Yeah,
and it's been listed. Oh, it looks like there's been...
Okay, so it's 108 million market cap. Seems to have a solid balance sheet, not too much, but a bit of cash on the balance sheet. And wow, it's a rocket ship. Look at the financials on this one. Okay, so my take on it is it's got to hit those numbers. So there's quite a lot of good news already in there. But if it is a licensing model and it's dropping down, then you'll see, look at the, yeah, there you go. There you go. The operating margins are absolutely taking off because you can see all the operational gearing. It comes down to really, do you believe in the Slingo Bingo band? Would be mine. And if you do, and they can expand faster than that top line, then the shares are going to continue going up, I'd say. On terms of valuation, the PEs here don't really work very well because they use reported rather than, oh, look at the, that's on reported numbers. That's not on adjusted. Yeah, right. I mean, 15 times reported PE is pretty cheap. On an EBITDA, 7 times, I'd say because it's in gambling, then you're going to get a discount. But that doesn't look expensive, even though the chart. Let's have a look at the chart. The chart. Oh, okay. It's one way up, isn't it? In fact, over the last year. Let's look over 5 years. Okay. Well done, Lemon Physical. I think you've probably made quite a bit of money if you bought around about 5p and it's the 36. I mean, you're a bit of a chart expert, aren't you? I mean, what would you say for the chart on that? That's the 50-day moving average, and I'll get the there's the 200 mark. I mean, it's above the 200 day. I mean, frankly, not much. So looks pretty much intact to me, but you're the expert there, Graham.
We do chart of the day, Paul.
Yeah, you have to chart of the day. You're right, brilliant.
Yeah, we'll do chart of the day. Higher highs, higher lows, but possibly needs to break psychological resistance of 40.
Okay, good. All right, well, brilliant. Okay, well, I think we'll close it there. We've done a great hour, and thanks very much again, Graham. We've run through some excellent stocks that people are going to have a look for, and I guess in the next 2 weeks, anything which is going to sort of pique your interest. I think we've got the UK banks reporting, haven't we? NatWest came out with something this morning. I haven't seen it, but they've got all this the motor car insurance thing to report out and to provide for, I guess, as well.
Yeah, I mean, the FCA is sort of front and center at the minute with this review into motor commissions. So personally, I'm quite curious to see what the outcome is there. And the FCA also seeming to want brokers to pass on interest to customers in a high rate environment. That's one of the things that Jarvis might be involved with. There might be pressure to do that. So I'm kind of hoping to get some news on both of those FCA related topics pretty soon.
Yeah, that's the consumer duty thing, isn't it? Which has hit a lot of AJ Bell and Hargreaves Lansdowne hit them hard, didn't it? Oh no, in fact, it hit St James's Place massively, didn't it, 6 months ago?
Yeah, and I should mention I do own a small slug of shares in Hargreaves Lansdowne, so I'm quite curious to see how that one pans out.
Okay, well, next time I'll pick your brains on Hargreaves Lansdowne because I know that's a popular share that it's either a value play or a value trap. So we'll find out. So thanks again, Graham, and look forward to chatting in a couple of weeks' time.
Thanks so much, Paul. It's been a pleasure.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy.
Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, ugh, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams whew,
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,